Hello, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 130 of Cyclocross Radio. On today's show, we're taking a little bit of a left turn here. I know Kokusaida happened over the weekend, and there's a lot of other cyclocross news out there. And fear not, on a future TBD TIE episode coming up soon, we're going to cover all of that, plus everything else that's going on between the tape and even outside of it in the cyclocross world. But today we're taking a little bit of a left turn, and we're going to chat with Mickey Vukovic, who was here in D.C. For DCCX. He was able to mix a little bit of a business trip and also race on the East Coast, and it was awesome to have him here. Right now you may be asking, who the heck's Mickey Vukovic? Well, if you don't know, he's actually a guy who is really inspiring for me and what I'm trying to create here. He is the executive director of the Tony Hawk Foundation, which is amazing on its own, and that is something that you all should take a closer look at. Go to TonyHawkFoundation.org. They are creating skate parks in low-income communities and building skateboarding programs for the youth in those communities, and through that, you know, building up community, building up infrastructure, doing, you know, there are a lot of parallels between what we are trying to create in the cycling world to what he is creating on a whole different level. And it's right there. Awesome. But you go back further than that in Mickey's life. He's a guy who grew up in California, went to high school with Tony Hawk. They were buddies. They both skateboarded. Mickey turned out not to be as good a skateboarder as he was a photographer. So that's the route that he went. And some of the work that he created through the 80s and the 90s and even up in today, you know, working for Trans World Skateboard Magazine, being able to go all over the world and follow this sport and be there for the history of this sport is just amazing. It's mind-boggling to me, and it was really awesome to have this conversation with him. And you should check out MickeyVukovic.com to learn more about Mickey even after this conversation, and go check out the Atom Bomb and Other Pleasant Dreams, which is the photo book that he created that I just love, and we talk about it in this conversation too. And TonyHawkFoundation.org. It's a worthy cause. And speaking of worthy causes, that was a sweet segue right there. I also want to make sure that you know about the Wide Angle Podium podcast and other content network. wideanglepodium.com. That's where we have all of our podcasts. Also have Cyclocross Television on there as well. And you know, you look at that site and you hopefully you go there and you see what's new, and it may not look like a lot's going on as far as changes to the site itself, even though there's just a constant stream of new and awesome content. But you have to know, behind the scenes, we're scheming, we're planning, we're doing things to make this whole Wide Angle Podium adventure even greater. And we're going to be rolling out a lot of that in the coming year. And we want you to be a part of it, to be a member, to share in the awesome. And you can do that by donating wideanglepodium.com. Hey, while you're there, buy some coffee from Grimper Brothers. They created a blend just for us. It's called the Full Schleck. That's a reference to the Slow Ride podcast, one of the shows that you should check out on the network if you don't already. It's a good follow. Those guys are, just listen. They're fun. Buy the coffee, become a member. And then finally, the last thing I want to tell you, for those who have stuck around for me rambling to this point, is Cyclocross Television. That is where I've been putting all of the videos I'm creating for the C1 races and some C2 races in North America. And there are over 20 videos right now of race coverage. And how I get all of this stuff and enabled to do it, part of it is, you know, having sponsors like Maxis, which is awesome, and they've been a huge help to make that possible. But it's also as easy as just having you go to the YouTube page, go to CX Hairs under youtube.com and watching some videos. And every time you do that, all of those views turn into just a couple cents for me. And that's hugely important. And if you like them, if you subscribe to the channel, then those videos get recommended to other people outside of the subscribers. And then it's a couple more pennies, a couple more dimes. And it's those little bit of piecemeal pockets from the podcast to the contributions to the videos that allow us to continue to create. And that's what we want to do. So this one doesn't even cost you any money. Just go to youtube.com/CXHairs. Click on some videos, thumbs up if you like them, subscribe to the channel, and it's a huge, huge help for me. And the last thing you can do with that is share. You know, if you're on Twitter and I put it out there, just retweet it. That is huge. Doesn't cost you anything. I don't want you to do it if you don't like it, but if you think it's cool, don't just hit the like button, retweet it. All right. You can follow me at CXHairs on Twitter and Instagram. That's it. I'm done getting off the soapbox. Let's go talk to Mickey Vukovic in the basement. I'm going to do our intro before so people will already know who you are.
Yeah.
Mick, thanks for stopping by and being in the basement.
Oh, yeah. This is like, I'm in the basement. This is the basement. And it's a lot less dungeon-esque than I anticipated.
Yeah, so. I like to play it up as being, you know, I think it was Lindsay... who used to call it the murder basement. I don't think it's a, you know, this weekend, you're seeing it in its pre-DCCX chaos on that other side. And once that's cleared up, then we're going to have the Kerry Werner and Becca Farringer and Emily Shields will all be down here or throughout our house for our host housing.
Got it. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's kind of the
it'll be an all-star basement.
Yeah, well, you know, that's part of like you run the race and they got to do the host housing and we're still, it's kind of funny. It's almost like to whatever level you get to, it's still sort of grassroots at some level.
It's never just about the race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So just a little background on you, if we can. I mean, I know you because you actually reached out to me because you race cyclocross. And
as everybody should.
Yeah, which is awesome. But your other life outside of racing cyclocross is just insane. I love it. You know, just to hit the highlights. Well, starting from now, you are the director. What's your director? Executive director of the Tony Hawk Foundation. And basically, what's the objective? What's the goal of that foundation?
The goal is a skate park in every neighborhood. You know, we help communities through the process of planning and developing and funding public skateboard parks, free skate parks, and low income communities for kids. One of our early projects actually was just down the street from you here in DC at the Green Skate Lab. And, that was in 2004, I think. And, we've been going 15 years and just opened our 556th skate park.
Amazing.
We got parks in every state and we've got an international program through an organization called Skatistan to help kids in Afghanistan, Cambodia, and South Africa at the moment, skateboarding programming and helping them get education services and a lot of all that kind of stuff. And it's been amazing.
And, you know, we were talking and chatting a little bit about this before we started recording, but what I love is like, why do we need it? Why do we need skate parks?
Well, because kids are skating. I mean, I remember in the early 80s when all the old skate parks closed down, you know, at that time there were maybe 300 in the country and they were all privately owned and, you know, insurance went up and they shut down. And then if you were still a skateboarder at that time, everywhere you looked, there was, you know, no skateboarding signs. And there was essentially nowhere to skate. You're being chased. You're basically as a kid being told, you know, don't do this, go do something else, you know, essentially pick up a ball or a stick and you know, do something traditional. And, you know, a handful of kids stuck with it and they incubated something new, adapted it from the parks to the streets. and skateboarding came back big in the 90s as a street sport, basically. And, you know, X Games came along and saw something in it and started promoting it. And, you know, it just got more notoriety. And guys like, you know, Tony Hawk, who were articulate and could skate great and, you know, really show what it's about, helped grow it and bring it back. And so it really went from something that you know, society at large really systematically tried to eradicate to, and we're now on the doorstep of the Olympics in 2020. So
yeah,
it's come a long way.
What I like about it too, is that it started out, and I think at least, you know, we're the same age when I was mm-hmm. growing up, it was like this white kid sport. Mm-hmm. And since that time, and I think a lot of the work that you're doing, it's sort of across racial lines and income and neighborhoods and stuff. So even mm-hmm. here in DC, I mean, we got lots of parks in all the neighborhoods, and I think it's that's what I like about it, that sort of, I don't think it's a stigma, but that mm-hmm. that part of it doesn't exist anymore, where it's more right. universal for who skateboarding appeals to.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when we helped build the Green Skate Lab here at this in Northeast DC, you know, it was not an up and coming neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, there's kids all over who have access to team sports and leagues and stuff, and then there's kids who just want to get out and skate because it's free, and all you really need is a skateboard, and your city really is a skate park if you don't have a proper skate park. And so we're trying to create spaces where they can do all that in a place that's away from cars, away from pedestrians, and that they can help design and they can help work on and they can have some pride in helping create and make it their own space where they can congregate and have the benefits of really just being together and having a community.
So here's where I can pick your brain about something that I think would hit home with a lot of the folks who are listening mm-hmm. to this. On a whole different level, because we're dealing more with, you know, adults and, you know, some juniors, mainly adults and people who have jobs and stuff. But something that we run into is cyclocross practice and trying to find a place to have cyclocross practice. And it seems like we run into a lot of these same issues where being run out of parks or people not understanding what's going on or thinking it's, you know, ruining the grass or this or that. So from your work and your advocacy in the skateboarding realm, is there some advice that you can give folks who are like desperately looking for places to practice and maybe even convincing communities to allow?
Mm-hmm. Well, in San Diego, we have the SDCX group, and it's just like a training group. And we just barge at local parks and set up courses and do hot laps. And, you know, like, there may be a couple of moms and strollers, and we try and defer to them and let them pass by before we, you know, we do the countdown. I would just say start it small and start it DIY and keep it simple. If it gets to the point where there's a problem, where there's enough people coming that it's raising eyebrows and it's causing some conflict, you can at least at that point demonstrate that there's public interest in having this. There's this many people coming, and it's happening frequently enough that others are feeling, you know, that their space is being encroached. And then it's a conversation at that point. It's not like you're asking ahead of time where it's just a concept, you know. People can actually see what you're doing. It's athletic and it's kind of exciting, and there's a lot of people there to do it. And you've demonstrated that there's a need for it. And then it's like, well, where can we do it? Or can we do it here? And when would be good to do it? It's a public space, a public park. You should have access to it. You should be able to recreate there as you wish, you know, short of like smashing golf balls and through windows or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a pretty benign activity. If you tear up some grass, it's going to grow back. You can just move the course the next time around and not tear up the same spot. You know, there's ways to mitigate all that. And, I think it's just at first start it, you know, just do it. And then when it becomes a conversation, at least you've got something to talk about instead of, you know, speaking in the abstract. And it's much easier for someone to kill an idea before they can conceive it. And it's kind of the same with skate parks. You know, you talk about a skate park and people go, oh, we don't want those kids in our neighborhood. And then you got to remind them, like, no, these are your kids. Like, this is going to happen because your kids need a place to skate. And so that's, you know, with our work, it's about putting the kids out front and showing who they are and what they're doing and that it's positive and that they're fine, great kids. They're your kids. And I think with cyclocross, it's like, it's not this rogue element. It's people from the community. It's, you know, it's doctors, lawyers, and teachers, and it's everybody who does this, you know, on the weekends and, or, you know, whatever. And they're members of the community. And so, you know, I would just say, start doing it. You know, do your best due diligence to pick a time, you know, early Sunday or whatever, to get out there and, you know, go from there. And if it's not a problem, just keep going. And if it is, work it out and, you know, make it, get it legitimized or sanctioned or whatever you need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's it. And I think the problem, you know, in DC's part of the problem that occurred is folks were doing it more on federal land, which is going to always have a different, dealing with different agencies and all that kind of stuff always comes in there. But I think you're right, the local park, but it is also, it's got to, you know, I understand it. There are people who run parks who take a lot of pride in the way that their park looks. And, and they sort of, I think, hang on to it a little too tight and almost don't want people there to ruin what they've made in their park.
Yeah. No, if you talk to any parks officials, and you say, oh, we want to do this in the park, like, they're always going to put up some resistance because it just creates more work for them.
You know,
it's much easier to maintain a park that nobody uses than one that people actually use. But if, you know, if you make the point that, you know, this is here for the public good and cyclocross and cycling in general is good for the public, you know, and that this is a public space that's being paid for and it's underutilized. It's not cost effective to not have this going on or not to have something going on.
Right.
And here's something that's simple and we'll do it ourselves and doesn't require anyone to put themselves out. Just let us show up.
Yeah.
It, you know, it's just about framing it in the right way. You know, a lot of the people that we were confronted by with, you know, when we proposed a skate park in a certain area, you know, concerned about the quote unquote, the element and the crime and all these things that are just sort of phantom concerns, you know, and if you can introduce them to who actually will be using it and then, you know, frame it in an economic sense, like, here's something that's already, we're already spending money on and it's not being used. And here we're going to activate it and actually get some value out of it. It's going to, it's a value proposition versus, oh, we want a resource that's currently yours. You know, we're, no one, it's a resource no one's using and we're already paying for it. And we're simply going to put it to public use and a positive use and, you know, and then show how it won't impact their lives in any way or whatever. It's just about framing it in the right way, in ways that makes, you know, people are receptive to.
So, you have this very official title now, executive director of this, foundation, but you know, from your roots, it kind of started from a very, I'd say, unofficial part. And what I love about your past, A is the photography element, you know, just one, I love your photography and, you know, both the skating photography and then just what you've done. I mean, I'm looking at this, the Atom Bomb and other Pleasant Dreams book that you've put together, which, I want to chat about in a second, but just this all started from skateboarding, you know, what's kind of your history in the sport and how did you get in this? You know, you were kind of there at the rise of the sport.
Yeah. Well, I mean, skateboarding dates back to the 40s really. But it was in the 60s that it became sidewalk surfing and then it kind of went away. And then the early 70s, you know, the generation that spawned the Z Boys and the first real superstar pros came up mid-70s, late 70s. And that was the first introduction that I had and saw that generation of skaters. And that was happening around me. I was kind of young at the time. My brother skated a little bit. I played around on his board, but it wasn't until 1980 that I got my own. And at that point it was like, you know, I was 11 and I grew up playing soccer, you know, Eastern European parents. And you kind of followed my brothers in a lot of ways. And they were both older and great soccer players. And so I was a goalkeeper, of course. And that was at that point where I like discovered skateboarding or it discovered me or found me or whatever, and got hooked and realized that that was my own thing, that I was suddenly making a decision for myself that was unique and different from just following along with what others or what my brothers were doing. And it was in skateboarding that I, you know, first found like my identity. And, you know, I'm really looking back, real fortunate to have had that, and that opportunity, and then meeting other skaters and building my own community and, friends, and then, you know, congregating around the skate park at the time. And, you know, and from there, it's like, I didn't quite have the talent to follow the track that a lot of my friends were in turning pro, guys like Tony Hawk and others, but, I could pick up a camera and, you know, go to the sessions, skate with everyone for a while, pick up the camera, take some photos. And suddenly I felt like I had a role in what we were doing at the time, which was they were developing the sport and I was seeing new things happening every day. And I just felt like, God, that needs to be documented, you know? And
yeah. How did you get into the whole photography aspect of it? Because I like is that, you know, back, you know, you and I are the same age, but back when we wanted to start something like that, it sort of fell into what the advice that I like to give people now is that you just kind of have to do it, where we have this great resource today. You can go on YouTube and learn how to do anything. I mean, well, with skating now, you can go on a YouTube and learn how to do tricks or do whatever you want. And then same thing with photography. And then people sort of get like almost stuck in that, where in the 70s, you didn't have that option. You basically just had to figure it out. So how did this start?
Yeah. Well, high school photo class, got involved in the yearbook and just, you know, just started shooting. You learn by doing and by making a lot of mistakes. And I had a photo teacher in high school who would literally just give me film and say, go shoot it. And I had no idea what I was doing. And then I'd develop it and we'd look at the proof sheets and he'd be like, and he would just basically tell me what I did wrong.
Yeah.
And I go, okay. And you just sort of through the process of, you know, of elimination, you figure out, okay, well, here's how to do it right. And instead of him telling me how to shoot, he pointed out problems, then I had to make a decision about how to overcome that. And so you kind of develop your style that way. You're guided away from mistakes. And then you find what for you is the correct kind of path or approach. And so I think that was pretty key early on. And then my friend Grant Britton helped found Trendle Skateboarding Magazine. And within a couple of years, he was asking me to shoot some stuff, or I showed him some stuff I was shooting up in Northern California, that places that he wasn't getting to. And I sort of had my beat at that time.
Yeah.
And he used some stuff. I was still in high school and that was great. And then I was in school during the year, and summer I'd go travel to East Coast or Europe or whatever and come back, drop off some photos, go back to school and, you know, and then through college, you know, kind of made my way through college that way as well. So, and that was key, because it's like, here's an assignment, here's some film. And if I ended up with an extra roll of film from that session, I used it when I went and saw some bands that night, you know.
Nice.
And,
yeah, and, for sure.
So it was, you know, it was a great school and a great way to sort of develop, you know, just your skill and style and whatever.
Yeah, and it also, you know, skateboarding photography, there are a couple of things that seem like are go part and parcel with that. I mean, one, you know, you have your fisheye lens in a lot of these, and then also it's just the lighting. And that's the thing that I mean, I was asking you a couple of questions about just how you were lighting something before. And it's you know, by the time you're working for magazines, but you're still almost a kid when you're doing this, you know, you're not so old, but it's almost this like, and you're dealing with film. So you know, you sort of got it right. But it's like, that's just what I love, is like having these lighting setups, I think has been picked up by other sports and stuff. You're not seeing a lot of like, you know, having the daytime and sort of, overpower the sun and that kind of stuff in these pictures, which is were other guys doing that you picked it up from, or was it just creating that look?
At the time in the, by the mid 80s, Nikon had a camera called the FM2, and it had a flash synchronization at 1/250th of a second, which was, that was the key. And it allowed you to shoot in the middle of the day, or at least in daylight, and use a flash to fill in shadows. And suddenly you were able to capture the action from any angle. You don't have to wait for the sun or make a guy do a certain trick in a certain direction, which, depending on the spot, you couldn't maybe. And it really allowed the action to pop. And that was a key technical component. And then making sure you know, your flash was down at half power or less, so that the flash duration wasn't too long and create blurs and a lot of other technical stuff you had to figure out. But, you know, that was liberating. And at the time, you know, skateboarding was still pretty much illegal everywhere. So your setup had to be mobile. Like these days, a lot of guys will go out and they'll have like light stands and, you know, battery packs and all this kind of stuff and Hasselblads and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and they set up a whole
huge umbrellas.
And, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it's, you know,
flags and,
they probably even have permits, you know,
boxes.
But
back then
it was, you know, you knew it was illegal, so you had to be ready to bail.
Yeah.
And it was running, run and gun. And so everything, was attached to your camera. You know, anything, any lighting was either on your camera, or in my case, I used to, unclip it and handhold it. And my arms are relatively long, so I was able to kind of get, you know, angles that were a little wider or different or oblique. You know, and you just sort of experiment and, you know.
All right, so I'm gonna put this to back to cycling and mm-hmm. cyclocross again, because I know we have a lot of people who, you know, race, but then also are interested in documenting the races. So what would your main tip be? I know that like what you fall into, and we were actually talking about one of the mm-hmm. photos that you showed me where you were able to sort of get up high because you got kicked out of, you weren't credentialed, so you were kicked out of the photo corral and had to go find another spot. And then it became this great photo because you had to sort of be creative about it. And I think I see that a lot at when shooting races, both, you know, mountain biking and cyclocross, is mm-hmm. that there's definitely a style, you know, right. I see that a lot in mountain biking. There is this style, which is a great style, but mm-hmm. then a lot of the photographers know it's a great style and sort of fall into that.
Right.
And everybody sort of starts to look similar. So, you know, what do you think is a good sort of good key to sort of break out of that or find your own style, or even what would you, any kind of like, quick tip, I know I'm putting mm-hmm. you on the spot here,
no.
but kind of quick tip for people who are looking for those better shots at bike races.
Well, I think you have to ignore what you've looked at before in terms of photos. And I think when you're there at an event, because you're trying to capture what's the essence and what's important at that event or from that rider, you know. And I think that you need to just pay attention to what's really exciting you about the race or about the riding that's going on. Which course feature, what rider through what turn or over what, you know, barrier or whatever, you know, what's the key thing that just piques your excitement. And then once you've just figured that out, like, how would you show, like, what would you want to emphasize about it? And, you know, hone in on, is it the angle they hold their bike? Is it the, you know, the, how high they leap over the barriers? Is it, you know, the dirt flying off of their tire as they're just, you know, just sliding through a corner and staying upright. Like, and if that's what you want to focus on, then what's, you know, what's your angle? What lens you need? What, you know, what about the lighting? Are you shooting into the sun? Do you need to fill it in? Do you need to, you know, whatever, like you figure out what it is you want to show, you know, and then that should help you hone in on your angle and all the technical stuff. You know, the technical stuff is you want to have a bunch of things you can do in any given situation, a bunch of skill in approaching a photo or an opportunity. And then you get to pick and choose which technique you want to use to really bring out that one. What's that one specific thing you want someone to look at a photo and focus in on, you know, like, and you use a deep depth of field or shallow depth of field and just, you know, really isolate it, or do you cheat and do a deep depth of field and then Photoshop it and blur everything else out? You know, in the old days, you had to kind of pick exactly how you're going to do it and whether it's going to be black and white or color. And then, but just, you know, figure it out, like what, there's a whole day of racing. What are the three things that just stand out in terms of what's unique about that day and that particular setting and those particular riders and what they're doing, and then go from there, you know?
You talked also about, you know, that extra roll of film and going and shooting bands with it. That's something that, especially shooting a lot of cycling, I started also, you know, I mean, I did it back in college, but again, you know, now is like, I'll take a camera to a show every once in a while. And it's kind of, I'm sort of split in this, because the criticism, like, people say, oh, well, doesn't that, you know, shouldn't you just be there to enjoy the music? For me, that I'm excited about taking the photo part, that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. So that, I think for me, almost gets me more into it that I'm going to go shoot this music. I'm going to go like sort of document this, that I don't know, that is enjoyable for me. One, because it's just fun, something different. And then I think that also it gets me closer to the band. It gets me looking at things. It gets me kind of looking for details. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know what you're thoughts on that, but for me it was like something that was kind of novel and fun and gave that another excitement about being, of going and seeing music.
It was shooting bands for me has always been like, you know, you can go to the show and watch it and you know, pretty stand in the back and kind of go, okay, that was cool, or you can sort of have a task to do. You're like, I gotta take some photos, and that forces you up front. It forces you into the mix where you might be getting sweat on or getting beer spilt on you, and you know, under normal circumstances, you'd be all annoyed, but you kind of have the sense like, oh, I'm working, and I've got to, you know, there's a creative thing going on stage, and I got to respond to it with a creative thing going on with my camera. And, you know, if you've shot a lot of bands and clubs, and it's just like the black, you know, black painted background, and, you know, the monitors up front and mic stands and all the same, they all look, you know, every club looks the same. How do you make it different? And then you just, again, you look at the performers and what they're doing, you know, what's unique about what they're doing. You know, if we were looking at some Jesus Lizard photos, and you know, David Yao is just like falling over all the time. So you know, like, okay, I'm going to wait until he's like on his heel and about to flip onto his back, you know, like, and you just like, you know what you're looking for that's unique about that particular performer. And then you figure out where, you know, you want to place yourself based on where you think it's going to happen. Like, you're making all those creative decisions, and then hopefully it happens and you get it. And it looks different from that other photo. You know, if it's just a guy standing there, you know, strumming a guitar with the mic in his mouth, you know, in his face or whatever. You know, how many photos like that do you have? So what is that performer doing that's different, you know? And
yeah. And I think that's, you know, you can take it to the same, like how you treat your, skateboarding photography, mm-hmm. the same. I try to look at it for cycling, and just how I follow sport in general is that I like the stories, I like the personalities, mm-hmm. I like the drama in it. So it's beyond like, oh, isn't that, you know, looking at a cool guitar or a bike or whatever else, or a feature, and just getting almost to the soul of it. And you're talking about like music, I mean, looking for the body positions and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think it all sort of ties in.
Mm. Well, a good photo should stand on its own. It should be able to be interesting and draw people in without any context, ideally. But even better is if you can tell a story behind a photo of like who and what and where and when, and it somehow illuminates or illustrates something, you know, particularly in sport, and particularly like with cycling, and there's the human endeavor, and sport is the struggle, and there's the competition side, and there's, you know, there's what somebody's doing at the moment. But, you know, in racing, there's, you know, the racing is just one part of a long process. There's everything you had to do to get there, and to train up and to, you know, physically get there and deal with whatever, travel and stuff like that. So there's a lot in that image, you know, of a bike race shot. And sometimes it can come through and sometimes not, but it's like, what can you convey in that image? You know, like my first cross nationals was at Reno this last year. Mm-hmm. And I brought my camera and thinking, oh, this would be interesting. And it was interesting to see how often I got the angle wrong, you know, or I thought I should be here. And like, and I got some stuff that I liked, but it was definitely like, okay, I can adapt to this, but it's going to take some time.
Yeah.
It's not an instinct the way skate photography is. You know, but it was really fun and, fun to do, cause it kind of made me run around the course and, you know, sort of chase you around it, all day. But, it just made my experience at that race different. And of course I have these, you know, things to look at and remember that day. And I sent some photos to some of the racers, and that was cool. They were pretty excited. So, but you know, it's fun to take something I've done a long time and then adapt it to something that's still relatively new to me, and kind of marry those interests, you know, and it's just a great process. It's fun.
Yeah. We see that, you know, having been in there just, in the cyclocross world, mm-hmm. and then, we'll get photographers from other disciplines coming over, and it is kind of interesting. They're mm-hmm. trying to figure it out, and you can see what they're putting out there, and you're like, okay, those are the kind of shots that we were looking at, you know. And you see the evolution, and you know, obviously talented photographer, you're gonna catch on. But it is sort of fun. I found the same thing, you know, just even going from cyclocross to mountain bike, mm-hmm. You think it's the same, but it's mm-hmm. completely different. Yeah. I mean, it's just a completely different look. But you mentioned how every photo should just stand on its own, mm-hmm. But that you know, also to look at in a bigger picture. I'm gonna show you my ignorance on looking through this book where I did that and I was loving all of these all of your photographs that you put together. And then it finally dawned on me just looking at this page that these photos actually went together.
Yeah.
From the, and what it is on the left-hand side, it says west, and on the right-hand side, it says east on the, in the beginning of the book. And then I, which was actually, you know, it's kind of my ignorance in just sort of flipping through there the first time, but then going back, I'm able to enjoy this on a completely different level just to see the parallels that you've obviously spent a lot of time molding this and putting together. And then of course in the end when you're this, you know, I just completely glanced over that, oh okay, we're good, got explanations of each photo. Can you tell me a little bit about this book?
So my friend Rich Jacobs and his partner Patricia started a publishing firm, Muvalore, up in Oakland, California, a couple of years back. And he had been, you know, he put the bug in my ear like 15 years ago. Oh, we should, you know, like we should do a book. Like I did a story in Transworld Skateboarding in 1989. I think it came out in early January 90 issue. But I was in New York and I, you know, followed all the New York skaters around and skating all the Harlem Banks and, you know, all the spots around Manhattan and stuff. And so there were a lot of the skate shots, but I would also shoot, you know, this sort of landscapes, cityscapes. And those were little inset photos here and there. And he honed in on one photo from that article that was like this postage stamp sized shot of the urinals at the World Trade Center on the 108th floor. And it was like, I'd gone up there and I shot some photos of, you know, like the city from up there. But if you've ever been on the old trade center, like you can't see anything from up there because it's just so far away from, it was just so much higher than everything else that it just, you know, it just doesn't look like anything through the fog. So the one photo that I used from that was when I was down and I went down in the restroom on 108th floor and I just saw these urinals and I thought to myself, like, God, when you flush that, it's got to go so far down, like, you know, and it's just such an amazing thing to me. So that's what stood out to me at the time. Anyway, so that he honed in on that, it was like this minor little bit of this story. And I thought, yeah, you know, like every time I traveled to do a story, like I shot everything. I just shot everywhere, everything where we were, Europe or whatever. And, but none of that was ever really used. And so he's like, let's do a book based on like that stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, that's great. Like, good. Definitely shot it for, with something in mind, but never really had a purpose for it. And so the photos span over year, like from 1983 to like 2003, and they're all on shot on film. And so it was more about the places I've been. And when we kind of did the final select, and it was really a collaboration between me and the publishers, which was really interesting and fun to do. It turned out that, you know, about half of them were, you know, Western Europe, US, and the other half were like East Bloc, Russia and, you know, Poland and places like that. And so then I go, okay, well, that's interesting. So I made two piles and then I started looking at them and made some interesting comparisons. It just kind of came together that way.
Yeah. Yeah. No. So for instance, that picture of the urinals and then what's on the other side is.
Yeah. The Russian cops with their batons and, you know.
Yeah. So it's three urinals and then these three just leg down or torso down of these three Russian police officers with their scary looking batons.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I love it. So is where is this available?
You can find it at the Muvalore website, MOVELORE.com. You can look them up on Instagram and can link to it, or my website, MickeyVukovich.com. Links over there too, as well. And at your better indie bookstores.
Yeah, for sure.
Around the country.
Definitely. I mean, if you all are interested in photography, or, you know, Mickey's got a great story here in the beginning as well. It's worthwhile picking up, really. Enjoyed that. Any other projects like that in your head?
You know, not currently. Been doing some exhibits and shows and stuff. San Diego, we have a club called the Casbah, which is the famous, you know, hole in the wall that, you know, everybody's played at over the decades. And they recently did a kind of a show, a photo show looking back at their last, you know, 25, 30 years of different bands that have come from San Diego. And so I was in that and did some, put up some stuff there. But yeah, nothing publishing wise currently. Been doing some talks, you know, with some photos and showing stuff and running some stories.
What you just ran through with me before was just wonderful. So if, and you got to come to the East Coast and do that.
Oh, that'd be fun. Yeah.
We got to figure out a way to set up some shows for you. That'd be pretty sweet.
But, you know, first, just got to get on my bike and race a little bit.
You know? I know, which is awesome that you're here. And, you know, you sort of sent me this story, going, hey, it's just going to be around and we're going to race DCCX, which I'm stoked about that. You're going to be able to get out there this weekend and, see what we do in the Mid-Atlantic.
Yeah, no, I was really excited. It's, you know, an East Coast cross race has been on my bucket list for a long time, whether it's DCCX or Gloucester, one of these. And out west, you know, we have these sort of dusty, dry, fast, you know, I guess you call them dirt crits, but it's fun, but it's just, there's a whole other mythical element to what you guys are doing out here. And I definitely wanted to give it a try. So I'm really happy to be here. And I probably bit off more than I can chew. I've got two races on Saturday.
So. No, it'll be good. It'll be fun. But you, I mean, talking about biting off more than you chew, you do some of these epic rides out there in California. The one I'm thinking about is the Belgian Waffle Ride.
Yeah. BWR. It's great. It's really the signature event. And I think in SoCal, it really pulls together the best of the terrain we have from, you know, great roads and some climbs. And you know, we've got everything from flat coastal routes to rolling hills to real mountain climbs, not too far east, and kind of strings a lot of that together with some trails. And you know, it's a pretty brutal day, but I managed to do it five times so far.
That's and, great. Yeah, yeah. That it's something that early on, when Spy was involved with it, I had a little bit of a relationship with them and was meant to go out. Never made it there. Now I fear, like, fitness wise, I don't know if I could hack it. It looks pretty brutal.
No, it's a big day. I mean, you know, it's 140 miles, about 100 miles on the road, 40 miles off road, 11,000 feet of climbing. A lot of it's dirt and gravel climbing. So it's really just a pacing issue. I don't think you'd have too much trouble getting through it.
Where did bikes come into the whole picture for you?
For me, about 9 years ago, I had some issues with my knees. I think a lot of people end up with this around 40, 41.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing some running and playing a lot of soccer, and it was just, you know, tough on the knees. So I decided at the time, I was actually at Melajani's shop in Austin at a nonprofit conference, and I saw the bikes there, and I just thought to myself, that would be a good, you know, a good way to maybe fix my knees up and do less running, do more of that. And, you know, I put together an old 80s Peugeot and they're doing laps around the neighborhood and then around the town and then around the county. And it just grew from there. And then at some point I saw a cross video. I think it was the hour in hell video from Oregon.
Sure. Yep.
And for some reason, cause I'm not like a competitive person, I'm a skateboarder. I thought, wow, like, I got to try that. And there was a race nearby coming up and I just jumped in and, you know, like that was it.
That's, you know? Yeah. And those are the kind of stories that I love. Cause it's, and what I think is great about cyclocross for everything that you said is like the barrier to entry is low. It's not like getting into a road race. And then it's also, you can sort of choose your own adventure about what you want out of it.
Yeah.
You know, you can be super competitive, but also if you just want the challenge of going out there and racing and sort of testing yourself for 30, 40, 45 minutes, you can do that too.
Yeah. No, at first it was just about survival. And then, you know, I have modest ambitions, but it's like every year I just kind of set my early season goal and see if I can get there. And it's more about the pursuit than the, you know, than achieving it.
Yeah.
And, you know, at 50 now, I'm just looking to keep something that keeps me active. And it's fun. It's, you know, first this was my escape from my normal world. And then quickly I realized at races, I was running into people I knew and skateboarders who were also other skaters doing this. And I guess it's just a natural kind of connection and progression from one and adding the other. And, it's been really fun journey.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that just, talking again, just about your past, well, maybe when people hear your story and the stories that you tell, it's it's this you were sort of there at this amazing piece of history just with with skateboarding and everything, and then even coming in and you know, you went by and visited Ian MacKay and the Discord House and you know, and that whole sort of punk rock revolution that was happening on this coast, and they went over to California, and just being in the middle of all of that. I mean, that's one, do you have an appreciation for that? I know just from the outside looking in, it's like, holy cow, the history that you've seen. And then, I am sure people have said this to you before, but that would be the thing I think that we would love to see, is that you kind of giving that history somewhere, some sort of book, whatever. I mean, I think the stories that you have to tell could be pretty cool to get out there.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had a unique vantage. And it was really right place at right time. You know, I literally was a 12-year-old kid in NorCal when my skate park closed, and I knew there was one in San Diego. And I literally talked my mom into moving to San Diego so that I had a skate park.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And she's like, oh yeah. Like, you know, it coincided with her need to kind of do something new. And, you know, it's one of those serendipitous things. And, but you know, I think it was a combination of just my natural curiosity and then really my limited ability as a skater. You know, like I could skate and I loved it, but I wasn't, going to be a pro. And so I kind of was always kind of an outsider to all of the innovation, but at the same time, right in the midst of it and fascinated by it and, could really appreciate it from, you know, from the vantage of someone who saw what people were doing right around me and just not fathoming how they were able to do it. And then, you know, being able to document some of it. And so, yeah, I'm lucky and, you know, circumstance just had me there at that moment. And, so yeah, I don't know. It's been a trip.
You know? Fantastic. And any, just out of, you know, having traveled around the world with skateboarding, there's just on your own, anything else, what else other than racing, you know, on the East Coast for a cyclocross, what else is on the bucket list? What else do you want to do?
Climb Vaughan 2.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I think, I want to ride cross nationals at some point, probably Tacoma next time around.
Yeah, that's gonna be fun. I'm looking forward to that one out there.
And it's not so much to ride that day, but for me, it's like, it's okay, it's on whatever date, and then I work back from that.
Sure.
And I plan out, literally, I'll plan my year and work up to it. And for me, it's fun to, it's the discipline of trying to getting up, you know, or five on weekdays and getting on the trainer. And, you know, like that's really been my path in cycling is, do I have the wherewithal to fit in all this stuff with everything else that's going on and you know, have it achieve something, you know, move the needle a little bit and see, just test myself, see what I can do. I think that's really should be anybody's goal. Like based on where you're at, what can you do? And, you know, set a goal and try to achieve it and then move forward, you know? So
awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, dude, thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. And, a few years ago, I was on my friend David Glander's podcast, and he was like, I'm like, what's a podcast? And he's like, oh, you come in and we record it and we put it on the internet. I'm like, that's great. He goes, you know, there's some cycling podcasts like CX Harris. I'm like, oh, what's that? And then here I am. It's a trip.
That's awesome. So, oh, I love it. That's great. Well, it was a joy to have you here. So I really appreciate you coming by.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks, guys.